Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. It's a special edition. This is our special holiday show, which I think this is our third one, where I don't review a book or talk to an author, but I simply argue with my esteemed manager, Donna McFadden, who I'm introducing now. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Sam.
And we're going to be talking about the best books we've read in 2016. And I'll be talking a lot about the people I've interviewed, one, because they're such fascinating books, and two, I can just look back at my notes and I don't have to do any work to get ready for this. So what I thought we would do first is talk about what, like, our bestest book of 2016 was. And this year, in a lot of ways, it was a book called The Unseen World by Liz Moore. And Liz Moore also visited our shop and talked about her book, and we had lots of people come and see her. And she's just really a pleasure. But the book, why don't you give a summary of the book, and then we can talk a little bit about it.
Well, first I'd like to say I don't think we've ever argued about anything. But that aside, The Unseen World is a story of a daughter's quest, I guess, to discover the truth about her father's hidden past. The main character is a shy homeschooled child prodigy named Ada, and her father is a brilliant, kind of socially inept single father who directs a computer lab, and it takes place in the 1980s in Boston. And when her father's mind begins to falter, his mysterious history starts to unfold, and the daughter has to sort of go on this mission to uncover her father's secrets, a process that carries from her childhood all the way to her adulthood. And in addition to this kind of father-daughter and mystery that's layered on top of it, there's the virtual universe world, because her father's a computer scientist and is working on, I don't want to give too much away, but there's a virtual universe element to it, and it really is a great mystery, a little, not really science fiction-y, what would you say?
Well, that's the thing about it. I mean, we were talking on the way over about whether we were going to talk about genres, and it doesn't really fall into a genre because... And this is true of her first book, Heft, also, which I really liked. I like both of her books, and as I said when she came and talked, she comes at you kind of sideways. You go into the book and you don't, it's like a quarterback getting sideswiped. You don't really know what's happening. And this book has, like, elements of a mystery and elements of a kind of semi-love story and elements of an adventure. And then there's this, yeah, you can call it science fiction-y aspect of it. And then it's also the kind of book that, when you're done with it, you can argue or discuss with people because there's different interpretations you can make, again, without giving too much away, about the conclusion about...
Which we did not agree on. We each came to different conclusions on the ending.
Yeah, and then we brought that up with Liz, and she was, as most of the authors I interview are, she was kind of open to me doing whatever I wanted with
her. Right, to her own interpretation.
Yeah, and they always seem happy about that, actually.
So one of the things I did in preparing for this was to look at the New York Times 100 most notable books of the year. And there were a lot of books on there that I had read, which I maybe enjoyed, but certainly wouldn't consider notable. I think this book could replace a lot of the books that were on that list. There's a lot to talk about, which is always fun when you're reading a book. If you give it to somebody else and say, then we need to discuss this. It's well written. It's an original story.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, you know, she teaches at Holy Family. She's like an assistant professor of English literature. No, I guess she's a full professor. And but then you have a book like The Girl on the Train. It's optioned into a movie. What's the other one? Peculiar.
Oh, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
Yeah, it goes from I Talked to Him Twice. It goes directly to movie. They both make millions and millions of dollars. And this is the kind of book that I think would translate cinematically very well.
Absolutely. I'd love to see it as a movie.
And, you know, she's talked about some interest in it, but, you know, it's really a crapshoot. It's really a lottery with these people. And so she has to still make ends meet, but she's been reviewed by the New York Times, and the review was an excellent review, and you would think it would gain some traction. Hopefully it still will.
Hopefully it will. So that's a book we actually agree on. I wonder if we agree on any more.
Well, it's funny because, like, this is off of my notes. Not that I have any, really. But, you know, like, so this year I interviewed Jodi Picoult, and I interviewed Alice Hoffman. And whether they're listening to this or not, but I can't imagine that anyone is really listening to this. But if they were listening to this, yeah, well, anyway, so...
I would say Liz Moore is right up there with any of those best-selling
authors. Yeah, well, that's the thing. I wouldn't normally read a Jodi Picoult or an Alice Hoffman book, but when I interview them, I like the books. But, I think this book would definitely be right up with them as terms of literature, more so.
Well, in terms of some of the authors that you've interviewed this year, you had the pleasure or the privilege maybe even of interviewing Amor Towles, author of A Gentleman in Moscow.
Yeah, that's a good segue. That book, it's not so much, it's like the other one, Arturo Perez Reverte. His first book, The Rules of Civility, I think the first year we did this, we probably talked about that being our favorite book. And this year, it would be close to my favorite book. It's not as plot-driven as...
Absolutely character-driven novel. For people who aren't familiar with it, it's about a count in Russia who is ordered to spend the rest of his life inside a luxury hotel, the Metropole Hotel, which is a beautiful institution in Moscow. And
it covers 5 decades that he was incarcerated, not incarcerated, but under house arrest. And it goes from the beginning of the Russian Revolution into the 60s, I guess.
Yes. I the thing about Amor Towles, to me, he's an Anthony Doerr. Everything he writes is just, it's just beautiful. I mean, I say everything he writes. He hasn't written a lot. I really would like him to get busy on the next one because I love reading his writing. It's just exquisite.
He's not even an author, really. I mean, he's an investment banker that's just decided.
I think he's really an author.
He is, but I mean, he never really... I went down to the library to hear him talk about this book. And instead of talking about the book, he talked about the Russian Revolution.
Yeah.
And he painted it verbally as well as he would have done in writing.
Well, the research that must have had to go into a book like that.
Remember that author that said, you don't want to let your research show?
Yes.
Who was that?
I don't know, but he does a beautiful job of just weaving it into the story. You'd think he was probably Russian growing up in the time that the book takes place because it's that seamless.
Yeah, and as you said, it's character driven, and what happens is you, by the end of the book, you feel like you know the person as if you know a real person or a real friend.
Well, are there other fiction books that you really liked this year? Because I have a few.
Yeah, you do one, and then I'll figure one out.
I was a big fan of The Girls by Emma Klein. What is amazing about this is it was her debut novel, landed on the New York Times bestseller list. Just well-written, great story. I'll go ahead and segue in with one of my other favorites, which was Another Brooklyn by Jacqueline Woodson. I feel like both of those two novels, they're writing about teenage girls, they just nail it. That they capture the mind of a teenage girl pretty much as well as anyone could other than being a teenage girl at the moment. So that's one of the things that really drew me to the novel.
Well, it's funny because another one that I can't remember whether you read it or not, but it's Do Not Say We Have Nothing by Madeline.
I did not read that yet. It's on my bedside table.
And it was shortlisted for the Man Booker, although the sellout won the Man Booker, but it was shortlisted for the Man Booker, and it's a great book. And it's about the Cultural Revolution and Mao, and China in the 50s and 60s, and it also has young girls who kind of run the book in a sense. They're the protagonists, but it's beautifully, beautifully written. It's almost like poetry, and it combines music and science. And it was just really—it's one of those books. You know, at the beginning, you look at it and it has this big family tree at the beginning, and you go, "Oh no,
yeah.
I don't want to."
Can I do this?
Yeah, and then you flip back to it a couple of times, and then you pretty much have them all down. And she was a lovely, lovely person to talk to, and it was—I would say—yeah, definitely one of the best books of the year, in my opinion.
Okay. I also liked, and I know, well, I'm pretty sure you didn't read Grief is a Thing with Feathers by Max Porter. Sure. Tiny little novel. It was just beautiful. I mean, as beautiful as it can be, talking about grief and death. And I just wrote down one line from the book, which is, grief felt fourth dimensional, abstract, faintly familiar. And I thought, I think to people who are really going through grief, it is sort of fourth dimensional. And that's just kind of a taste of how he writes and how he describes this process of grief that he and his son go through. And it was beautiful.
What do you mean it's fourth dimensional? Like outside of our waking day-to-day reality or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, it's new. It's not, yeah, it's something, it's a totally different dimension of what you've experienced before.
Well, that's interesting because that goes to my first nonfiction one, which is one of my favorite authors, James Gleick, who I've been reading for years, and I couldn't even believe that he came on the show, but he wrote, his current book is Time Travel, A History, and he wrote The Information, he wrote Chaos, which I think our nonfiction book club is going to be doing, and he wrote Genius, The Life and Science of Richard Feynman, who's my absolute hero, and he also wrote Isaac Newton. But the thing about it is that he's a science writer, a popular science writer, which is sometimes sounds denigrating, but it's not at all, because he conveys so much information so fluently and eloquently that, you know, you find yourself learning everything but the formulas without even trying. And, you know, this book is like, what is time? Why is there so much damn time? What's the romance that draws us to time? You know, how does time, like, dilate for a conscious...
Well, we read very different nonfiction books. No, I'm saying we just choose.
But if you read this, I think you would feel the same way.
Yeah, maybe.
He draws on a lot of science fiction. He draws on science fiction because the book starts with H.G. Wells and the Time Machine. And he says that's the first time in literature that anyone actually dealt with the subject. And then he moves forward from there, and he has all these references to...
So a book for nonfiction lovers as well as science fiction lovers.
Yeah, but it's also... I mean, if you have any curiosity about the world around you, or just like if you look at life as, you know, an opportunity to gain as much information as you can during the short time you have here, I think that it's a good book, and he's a great author for that.
Well, one of my favorite nonfiction books was Upstream by Mary Oliver. Mary Oliver is an icon. She's an institution, and at 81, she could certainly rest on her laurels, but as she proves with this collection of essays, there's no laurel resting for Mary Oliver. I mean, it's just like everything. It's honest, it's open, it's reflective, and above all else, it's encouraging. I loved this book. I think if you're a Mary Oliver fan, it's one of her best books. I think if you're not a Mary Oliver fan, you should just give it a peek there. She usually does poetry or does a lot of poetry. This is essays. And just the wisdom of an 81-year-old. I would say her work is simple, but simple in a way that it's also profound.
Is this the book that Claire blogged?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm.
So if you look at our blog, which is
check
great.
Out our website.
Yeah. You can see that this book is blogged by Claire, who's 16 and works in our bookstore and really has, you know, all kinds of insight for someone that age.
And, yeah, probably does a better, more eloquent job of me in describing it.
Well, what is it? Is it just essays?
Yeah, it's essays, but, you know, just essays. But essays, from a wonderful writer and poet who's...
Does she
got
use
81
the,
years under her belt.
Is that what it is? Does she use the perspective of her age to give you advice?
I don't think she gives advice. It's more of observations. And I think the observations of an 81-year-old can resonate even with a 16-year-old. Certainly Mary Oliver's observations can.
I can do that in 16 years.
Yeah. So, but another book I want to talk about, nonfiction book. And I don't know that anyone else in the bookshop read it. It's The Avid Reader, A Life by Robert Gottlieb. What an interesting guy. He kind of, stumbled into a job at Simon & Schuster, ended up running Alfred Knopf. He was editor on Catch-22, The American Way of Death. He's been an editor for Doris Lessing, John le Carré, Lauren Bacall, Katharine Graham, Bill Clinton, not to mention Bruno Bettelheim. Just full of interesting stories and his experience through publishing, through editing, meeting these interesting people and what all these authors were like. It certainly isn't a dishy memoir, but if you love books and you love writing and you love the whole process, I found it delightful. He does go on to talk about he's got a love of dance and he's been very involved in the New York dance world. That part didn't appeal to me as much, but I would say delightful, just a fun read of going back, 50, 60 years in the book world.
It's funny, when I interview people who are in the book or magazine world, like when I interviewed the guy who was the editor of the New Yorker. When I interviewed the woman who was the assistant editor of the Paris Review.
Yes.
You think they would be kind of boring, but they're not.
They're so full of stories.
Or the comma queen from
yes.
New Yorker.
Yes. Yeah. Mary Norris.
Yeah, it's funny because it's like lawyers trading war stories about their trials. It's always really interesting and always really funny, and there's all kinds of cool stories. Let's see.
Hey, I have a fun thing, and we didn't talk about this.
What?
But I'm thinking if I had to pick a book for you that I don't think you read that I think you would like, it would be my next book, The Atlas Obscura by Joshua Foer. I didn't want to get him confused with his other overachieving sibling, Jonathan Safran Foer.
But it's not really a reading book. It's a looking book, right?
Well, yes, snippets. It's the kind of book you could sit down for 5 minutes and look at it. You could sit down for 2 hours and look at it. You could look at it today and pull it out again in 2 months, in 2 years. It's really, it's fun. It's fun. It's over 700 of the strangest and most curious places in the world. It's a wonderful book for people who love traveling or scientists or nature lovers or people who are just plain curious about the world.
Yeah, I was saying that. I didn't know what it was, but then I read, there's this article in the New Yorker this week about it, and what started out as a blog, and people would just submit their places that were the weirdest.
Yes.
Like one of the places is the quietest room in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so the article had rejects, like people who submitted for the blog but were either not as obscure as they should be, or they submitted it too late before the publication of the book. But it was fascinating, you know, tunnels where tunnels shouldn't be.
Yes. And I gave credit to Joshua Foer. It's also Dylan Thuris and Ella Morton who wrote it. But
yeah, the three of them got together and started the blog.
To me, it's a little like, my memory is fading. The, the book that the kids all like with the facts.
Yeah.
Why can't I remember that? I see the cover.
The one who does the cathedral books or the one
who does? No, just not Ripley's Believe It or Not, but...
Well, you can't have dead space on radio, so you either think of it or move on.
Okay, I'm going to have to move on. It'll come to me later, but it's like that kind of book for adults. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I say it's kind of a picture book. You're looking at the places that they've discovered.
But just jammed with facts and information. If you're an information person, it's really nice.
It's funny, you know, there's so many, like this one book I read, The Senility of Vladimir Putin. And it's really funny because the guy who wrote it, I mean, he trashes Putin horribly, says horrible, horrible things about him. And I said, you know, aren't you worried? You know, you got your family and all. He lives in London. He says, no, he's probably not going to read it. But now...
Maybe he will.
I know. And it's like you read it and you realize how what is meant to be satire is no longer satire. And it's, you and I talk about this.
Oh, no. Sometimes. Well, the world has proved us wrong. It's not a satire. It's...
Yeah, he's talking about how corrupt Vladimir Putin is, and the thing is, he is that corrupt. How if you go to visit him and you have a beautiful $300,000 Philippe Patek watch on, he looks at it, and then you're meant to take it off your wrist and give it to him. And if you don't, then the next day you better give him something that's just as good or better. And it reminds me so much of Trump and Putin together, and what a great team they'll make in the next 4 years. Because it's just, you know, it'll be this world of total corruption that no one can really check or balance or even argue against, especially against the backdrop of all this fake news now.
Is this the part where I rein you in?
It's a rant, but it's not really a big rant. It's true.
No, it's not. It certainly isn't a rant for you.
No.
But
it was a good book, The Senility of Vladimir P. Really good book.
And I'm going to regress. Atlas Obscura is like the Guinness Book of World Records for adults.
That's what you were trying to think of?
That's what I was trying to think of.
Jeez.
It's a lot of pressure, Sam. All of these listeners.
Well, I had already thought of that,
right.
But I thought that was too easy to say.
All right. Are we sticking with nonfiction, moving to fiction? I have a tiny little book. I don't know that people know about this book. What a fun little book for science lovers, for information lovers, tiny little snippets. It's almost like a bathroom book of science. It's called The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, Evolution's Unbelievable Solutions to Life's Biggest Problems by Matt Simon.
I saw that one in the bookstore, but it looked interesting, but I didn't pick it up.
First of all, it has a great cover, but it is just this eclectic collection of weird nature and evolutionary tales and small snippets of some crazy stuff that go on in the natural world, and I found it enthralling. And again, you could just tiny little stops here and there, bathroom, cooking, whatever, just open it up and get some cool information about nature.
We have a lot of books like that at the bookstore.
Yes, we do.
And a lot of them are just like kind of laid out on the table, and you almost can't really resist picking them up because usually the covers are good. Oh, what are those National Geographic ones we have, like all the Instagram pictures?
Oh, yeah, Instagram photos from around the world. Yeah, gorgeous photos. I'm sure, you know, photos people have taken with their iPhones, but just, and they're sized nicely, so it's, I mean, it's a heavy book because it's pretty thick, but you could throw it in your purse, you could throw it in your backpack, take it around, and just look at all these beautiful photos.
I know. It's another one you wouldn't think of looking at because it's Instagram, but then there's like that one, the Maasai warrior with the water buffalo.
Yes, all over the world. Instagram photos that you probably can't even imagine exist and taken by Instagram users. So, yeah, that's a cool book.
Well, like I said, continuing with the idea that the Great American Experiment was begun at some point in the past, and now I think in the next 3 or 4 years is going to end because of what's going on. And I'm not really ranting, because a lot of the authors I speak to now, they all have the same feeling about what's going on politically in the United States right now, and they don't hesitate to express those feelings. They don't do it in a vituperative way, and they don't do it in a mean-spirited way. And I have a couple of authors coming up who talk about these things. But I mean, I read by Fergus Bordowich, The First Congress, How James Madison, George Washington, and a Group of Extraordinary Men Invented the Government. And you think back to that time and what they did, it's like the Beatles, like all these people came together at one time, and it could never have ever happened again. And how...
You know, I'm really trying hard not to sing when you give a Beatles reference. You talk about coming together.
Don't sing. Go ahead. No, you want to sing?
Come together.
Jeez.
Right now.
So anyway, so when I think of the idea of all the work and all the genius and all the invention and all the philosophy they relied on in order to create the documents that framed our government and made it this great American experiment, and now you have an idiot tweeting these things out, and you have a country buying into it, and I'm going to be interviewing an author who's written a book about the right, the alt-right, the Tea Party people. And what she tries to do, and I applaud this, is she tries to talk to them and listen to them and figure out why it is that they are so, in my opinion, idiotic. But she doesn't come at it from that point of view, that where I'm not a listener. She listens to them talk and listens to their fears and frustrations, and it really gives you an insight into how people, just like the Germans after World War I and the Treaty of Versailles, they felt like they had been stepped upon, like their country had been destroyed. They had no real self-esteem left, and that's what gave rise to the things that occurred in the 20s and 30s. Well, and I think it's the same atmosphere now.
That makes me think of Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of family and culture in crisis.
Which I won't read because of the title.
By J.D. Vance. It's a really interesting, I'm sure probably a lot of people have heard about it because it's gotten a lot of press, and he's... done a lot of television and talked about the book and things. But he's a former Marine, and he's a Yale Law School graduate and, very successful guy who talks about his growing up in a poor Rust Belt town. And it's about the struggles of America's white working class, which is, you know, a big departure from a lot of the books that we typically read. And I'm talking about the people in the bookstore and the books that we typically sell there. But it is a moving memoir it's got funny parts to it. He's got very colorful characters in the book, all actual people in his life. But it's the story of how upward mobility really feels when you're sort of still dragged down by your past and the, what's a good word for it? Your history, your family history.
Your baggage.
Yeah, your baggage and your family's baggage. So it's, you know, kind of a troubling meditation on the loss of the American dream for, you know, a segment of the country that is, you know, what you're talking about earlier, the people who have voiced their their frustration. And so that's kind of the other side of the coin. So, but very much worth taking a look at to understand both sides of what's happening. Well, I don't, probably more than two sides, but...
Well, there, you know,
one of the sides to what is happening.
The problem is that the people who have elected the, what, you know, is amazing for me to say, the President of the United States, they come at this from a position of fear and entitlement that to things that they thought they always had, but what they forget is by they're climbing the stairway of danger and loss of freedom to get to that point. And I've forgotten the name of the woman I'm going to interview next week, but she talks about that and how, yeah, they're really nice. They have, you know, church socials. They raise money for families at Christmas that don't have it. They give money to the Salvation Army. They're good people, but they just kind of lose sight of the fact that their cities are being polluted. Where they used to fish, the fish are poisoned now. They lose sight of that. They lose sight of the BP oil spill. They go, oh, well, you know, there shouldn't be government regulation because these companies are trying to do their best.
Well, and I think they lose sight of that, and this is a little bit of what Hillbilly Elegy goes into, is they lose sight of it because what's going on in their own lives, their immediate vision, it is what consumes them, and it's not a pretty picture. And I'm not trying to defend that at all, but I'm just saying Hillbilly Elegy is a kind of an eloquent book on explaining.
I'll read it because everybody's been saying that, and I'd leaf through it, and it does look really, really good.
Okay. Well, I still have a couple of fiction books I want to get to.
Okay, we're 26 minutes, so go ahead. You're going to go on, like, you've already taken up most of the time.
Oh, have I? We'll see. I've been listening to you.
You haven't even gotten to your damn cookbooks yet.
No, I haven't, and you know I have a lot of cookbooks. But first, I want to talk about Home Going.
All right, go ahead.
I want to talk about Home Going by Yah Jesse.
Well, I interviewed.
I know you did, so we can both talk about that. I love the book. It's set in 18th century Ghana. One of the things, I love books that are about things that we don't read every day. I mean, some of the best books that have been written, some of the best novels that have been written even recently are World War II, Germany, France, and those are great books. But I love this book because it's 18th century Ghana. I haven't read a book about that in a long time. Story of two half-sisters separated, and one is sold into slavery while the other is married to a British slaver. So it's a powerful book. It traces generations of the family following their destinies across continents over 300 years. And it's really a comment on the legacy of slavery and even to the light of the present day. So, very powerful book.
It was another one that had a family tree, and it had a long family tree.
Yes, it did.
But
with difficult names.
Yes, but it was really good. It was a really good book, and it was. At first, I didn't think I was going to like it, but then when I realized it was this bicameral story of two people, it really kind of made sense to me.
Yeah, good book. Another one I really liked was My Name Is Lucy Barton by Elizabeth Strout. I know you didn't like this book. I think it's a woman's book. Again, it's a short book, but it's short and sparse, but it packs a lot of punch. It's a woman and her estranged mother who would attempt to reconnect while the woman's in the hospital. But I don't know. Something about it sort of resonated with me, and I admired the way Strout just puts so much emotion into so few words.
But nothing really happened.
Well, emotionally stunted man.
A semi-senescent?
There's a lot that happened there.
Not really.
Yeah.
You know, what is it that does this? You say it's a woman's book, and then I'm interviewing Jodi Picoult and Alice Hoffman, and I'm just automatically assuming they're women's books, and I wouldn't have read them other than the interview. And then when I read them, I still think they're women's books. But what is it? And why am I being so sexist about it?
Well, I think that's probably whole other... It's a book about a woman's relationship with her mother. So to me, that's what makes it a woman's book. I certainly don't mean to turn men off of the book, but when I talk to people, it's more women than men who will be interested in that book. So maybe it is very sexist.
And it is funny, though, you know, how the covers, you know, and I ask every author about the cover, but the covers are designed to attract either a male or female audience, and that's it. There's just no two ways about it. Like even the cover of Faithful, this little, whatever it has, little bluebirds or...
Yes, I would agree with that.
So no guy's going to pick it up. It is strange.
That could be true. All right, well, what do we get to talk about next? Kids' books? Cookbooks?
There was one I didn't talk about yet. Oh, yeah, I didn't talk about, and this kind of ties in with everything because it harkens back to another time that's not so far away that we've lost connection with it, which is Leslie Bloom's Everybody Behaves Badly, the true story behind Hemingway's masterpiece, The Sun Also Rises. And this was a book I interviewed her for, and she's very much a person who's like of that time and place. She's very elegant and very sophisticated, and very into kind of the material kind of world and the social kind of Algonquin roundtable world, the author is. And it was also our nonfiction book club pick, and it was kind of a double pick for the book club. It was unfair to them because in order to read this book, you have to read The Sun Also Rises.
That was going
again.
To be my question. You do need to read.
Yeah, you can't just read the book, but it really goes into some people love Hemingway, some people hate Hemingway, but it really goes into how manipulative he was in this book and how it was really, backstabbing his friends by creating them as characters in the book and accentuating their bad aspects and minimizing their good aspects, and how he kind of screwed them over. But and then he would tell them, I didn't really include you in the book, but it was, I don't know how to say Romana Clef, but it's a Romana Clef.
I think you just did twice.
It's not right. But, yeah, that was a good book, too. I enjoyed that.
Anything else among the adult titles? That?
Yeah, there's tons of them. We could talk about Butter, because I've done Butter and Salt and Cod and Paper.
Paper.
Yeah, and it's like there's these books that people write now. Well, Henry Pertowsky, I've always liked him. I've been reading him for years. He wrote To Engineer as Human. He wrote a book called The Pencil, which I didn't know David Thoreau's father is the guy who invented the pencil as we know it now, the Ticonderoga.
Henry David Thoreau's father invented the pencil?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they had a big pencil company, and it's the beginning of Ticonderoga and Dixon. Hmm. But there's these books that are written about staples, staples in the sense of things we use every day but forget that we use every day, like the pencil or like salt. And butter was a really good one because it's not something that's a necessity, but it's something that we pretty much...
It's a necessity in my life.
Yeah, and it was in the author's life, too. And, it talks about how no one knew anything about butter until some Mongolian guy was riding on his horse and he had a leather flagon of milk on his back, and as he was riding, it churned the milk and turned it into butter, and that's how butter first got discovered.
The best things come from accidents, don't they?
Yes, like the vulcanization of rubber.
Hey, I want to mention two books that I think will make good book club picks next year when they come out in paperback, because at least our book clubs are usually looking, because they're buying a lot of books, looking for them in paperback. One of them is called The Lost Painting of Sarah DeVos by Dominic Smith. It's a rare 17th century painting that links three lives over three continents in three centuries. It goes from Amsterdam in the 1600s to New York in the 1950s to Sydney in 2000. The concept may not be completely original, think Girl with the Pearl Earring or Girl in Hyacinth Blue, but it is well written, it's entertaining, it has its historical insights, and it's a bit of a mystery. I think book club picks will really like that. Book clubs will really like that. Another one is La Rose by Louise Erdrich, much heavier. But set on a North Dakota Indian reservation, two best friends, one guy accidentally kills the other man's child and as repayment gives his child to the man. An intense, layered, not for every book club, but if you're looking to read something for your book club that's not the same old, I think that's a good choice. And Louise Erdrich is a wonderful writer. So I just wanted to throw those in.
It's interesting how book clubs work. I mean, if you... You can summarize it, too, but, I mean, we have a nonfiction book club, which, like, 22 people come to each month, and we have our main book club, which now, what do we have, two sessions or three?
We have two sessions, which about 25 people in each session, so it's getting a little unwieldy.
And then we have the young adult one.
Mm-hmm.
And what else?
Middle grade. We're going to split the middle grade and elementary off, and I think, speaking of middle grade and elementary, so it was, some... book years are better than others. To me, this was a great year for that age group, for late elementary, middle school, early high school kids. There were books, big, wonderful authors like Kate DiCamillo came out with Rami Nightingale, which
and I
was
interviewed
a,
her on that
yes,
one, yeah.
She was a National Book Award finalist for that. Sarah Pennypacker, Pax, is just a beautifully wrought, compelling novel about the relationship between a boy and his fox. That's destined to become a classic. Wolf Hollow by Lauren Wolk is for, I think, middle schoolers, 10 and up. The Hour of the Bees. Kwame Alexander, who most people know his novel or his teen book Crossover, also followed that up with Booked, just a great story about soccer, family, love, and friendship, a little more diverse than some of the other books out there. Laurie Hall Sanderson, who started her Seeds of America trilogy with Chains and then Forge, finished it this year with Ashes. That's for 13 and up, but it's a return to the American Revolution. She's has made the American Revolution compelling for young people. Absolutely, take a look at that. And one of my favorite covers, which also has a great book behind it, is The Girl Who Drank the Moon by Kelly Barnhill. It's kind of a dark fantasy, sort of in keeping with traditional fairy tales, but it's really a compulsive read. I think that's one for the 10 to 14 age range. I think you could go older on that, absolutely. But absolutely worth taking a look at. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there. And Ghost by Jason Reynolds, which was another National Book Award finalist. Ghost is the character who wants to be the fastest sprinter on his elite middle school track team. But his past is slowing him down. So it's part of a brand new series from the Coretta Scott King winning author, Jason Reynolds. So definitely worth taking a look at those. Just a great year for books for those middle grade readers. I love when people come into the store and say, oh, I've, you know, my nephew is 12 or my son is 10 or, you know, my daughter's 13. What should she be reading? I wanted to read something good. I love picking out books for that age group, and we have a lot to choose from this year. So that's very fun.
Well, I spilled this entire bottle of water all over his new blotter.
Hey, and remember, one of our favorite children's author, Jen Bryant, a lot of her books have been illustrated by Melissa Sweet. And Melissa Sweet has her own book out this year. It's the story of E.B. White, the author of Charlotte's Web. And it's got Melissa's beautiful paintings and drawings in it. Just really worth taking a look at.
I find that it's interesting that, you know, I should have put the cap on this water. This is brand new.
I find it interesting that I have like 200 more books I want to go through, and you're talking about your water.
I spilled it all over his brand new calendar. I'll buy him a new one.
Okay, good.
No, I think it's interesting how young adult books, whether you are talking about The Hunger Games or Harry Potter, I find that, especially in interviewing some of these authors like Ransom Riggs and those books, Miss Peregrine's,
yeah.
Miss Peregrine books, they're all like, you know, they're fungible. You can read them and read them as an adult book. And even he said, I don't know where to put this book.
Absolutely. That book and a lot of the ones I just went over can easily be read by adults. Adults come into the store and they're sort of sheepishly, well, I really like YA. Well, there is some fantastic YA out there. That's why you like it, because a lot of those young adult books are really well written. They're compelling. They're intriguing. They're complex. Yeah, there's a reason adults like them. They're good books.
Yeah, it's and it seems like that overlap is occurring more and more often. And you just read off a whole list of books that's like that.
It was also a great year for children's books. One of my favorites is called The Night Gardener. It's by the Phan brothers, two brothers who write and illustrate this book. It's just beautiful. It's about a boy, William, who discovers, he wakes up one morning and discovers that the tree outside his window has been sculpted into a topiary of an owl. And in the following days, more topiaries appear, and they're these huge trees that are cut into topiaries, and each one is just more beautiful than the one before. And soon, William's gray little town is full of color and these amazing animals. And though there's a mysterious night gardener who disappears as suddenly as he appeared, William and his town are changed forever, and William sort of gets to see what the night gardener is doing. But it's a beautiful book. I guess everybody looks for something different in children's book. It's got to be a pretty book for me to really draw me in. And another one was The Bear and the Piano by David Litchfield. Just a bear cub finds this strange thing in the forest one day, and it's a piano. And when he touches the keys, it makes a horrible noise. But then he keeps going back and back to the piano, and eventually he learns to play these beautiful sounds, and his woodland friends are delighted by it. But the paintings, the pictures, I could frame them and hang them on my wall. They're so beautiful. And then
the one where he leaves the forest and joint, and then he comes back at the end.
Yes, and it's the cover's got these red curtains on it with the bear sitting at a piano, and it's so pretty.
Did you read that book at your?
We haven't read that at Storytime yet.
That's the other thing on Tuesday mornings at 10:30. We have Storytime, and now that's gotten to be like 20 some people too. Which what I want to go back to is the fact that we're talking about our bookshop. At the heart of this, which is Wellington Square Bookshop, and we really think that a lot of the things we do, you're not going to find in other bookstores, the ones that are left, or Barnes & Noble, and a lot of these things are this ability for the community to interact with us in so many different levels, whether it's Story Hour, or whether it's the book signings we've had, like Jodi Picoult or Liz Moore this year, or the various book clubs we have, or just the people who are regulars, and some of the regulars that used to go to Chester County Book, which, is no longer there. And it's really become, it's like kind of like a small town square, like a community.
Absolutely. It's become a community.
It is a community.
So, there were three books on my list that the Storytime kids did love. One of them was We Found a Hat, John Clausen. It's a follow-up to his earlier books, where two turtles find a hat, and the hat looks good on both of them, but there are two turtles, and there's only one hat, and you see how the turtles kind of resolve the dilemma, and the kids loved that, as well as Penguin Problems, which is, who doesn't love penguins, but this one is just penguins all over the cover, and it's all full of fun and games, and the kids loved it. And also, they saw A Cat by Brandon Wenzel. I had the pleasure of seeing him at the National Book Fair. He's a really interesting guy, along with Aaron Becker. Aaron Becker finished up his Journey and Quest series with Return. Just no words in these books, but beautiful. This one, he's been a Caldecott honoree for his past work. This is the finale of his trilogy, and it's just a spectacular. It's an emotional book with no pictures for kids. For kids, but also for adults as well. It's called Return, and it's after Journey and Quest, and I loved Journey. Quest I liked. Return, I think, is back to the quality of Journey. And one more is The Poet's Dog by Patricia McLaughlin, another well-known author, who's also a Newbery Medal winner. But it's just a poignant story about two children and a poet and a dog, and how they each help each other out and kind of show each other love that maybe the rest of the world isn't showing them. It's a really powerful and beautiful story.
What do we have? What was this year from Neil Gaiman, if anything? He did that. He did the mashup of all his essays.
He did, but he's got a big one coming out in January or February, a big Norse mythology book.
We have the
advanced reader copy, but that's definitely one that people are going to be watching
and
out for next year.
Yeah, I would love to interview him.
Yeah, Neil, if you're listening, give us a call because we'd really love to have you into the shop or chat.
After he listens to this, I doubt very seriously would be the impetus that would have him call.
Well, we sell a lot of your books. We're big fans.
Well, what was the one, the ocean at the end of the lane? Was that last year? That was last year.
That was a couple of years ago. Yeah, he's very prolific. He's always got something out.
Yeah, we could go back. There's so many things from
kids,
from
teens,
comics
adults,
to Doctor
yeah.
Who to the Sandman yeah. series. But yeah, he's his essays are really good. The View from the Cheap Seats or something?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's really good. Also, the other book we were talking about, like. Okay, there's all these Holocaust books, but there's this one that I read called The German Girl, which is a Holocaust book, but it's kind of like semi-pre-Holocaust. It's about the ocean liner, the St. Louis, that was the Germans allowed some Jews out, but they had to give up all their material possessions. And then they got on this really luxury cruise liner where they were treated really well by the German captain, who later was named a hero after the war. And they were going to be let into Cuba, and they all had visas that they paid a fortune for. And so the trip was lovely, and there's a budding romance between two young kids there. And then they get to Cuba, and nobody's let off. And then the ship wanders around. They cable Franklin Roosevelt. He doesn't respond. No other place lets them in. And then they finally have to go back to Germany. And then a couple of countries let a few of them in, but most of them, if not, 95% of them perished in the concentration camps. But the story is about one of the girls who was let off the ship and stayed in Cuba. And what happened to her for the remainder of her life, all of which was driven by the facts of the cruise, and especially one really poignant thing that only plays out when she does something that she's supposed to do, when she only becomes an old lady, and it's a very interesting ending because of that. So that was a really good book, too, The German Girl.
Well, are there any books that came out this year that you didn't get to that you're looking forward to reading over the holidays or hoping for some quiet time?
Well, now that you've talked about it, the one that won the Man Booker Award.
Paul Beatty's The Sellout.
Yeah, The Sellout.
Yeah.
Because just glancing through it, you know, it seems... Well, you were saying you don't like satire, so you're not going to read it. But, I mean, I love satires, and this is...
Yes, that's...
kind of a horrible premise, but...
I'm
not even
going to
talk about the premise.
Look it up. Next on my bedside table, next up to read is Swing Time by Zadie Smith. I am really looking forward to digging into that.
And you haven't read anything by her.
I haven't. I know. You're not supposed to tell people that. I manage a bookstore, and I haven't read anything by Zadie Smith, but that's about to change in a couple of days.
She's so smart. It's like she's like Hilary Mantel or something.
Yeah. And Moonglow, Michael Chabon's new one. That looks really interesting.
Have you read stuff by him?
Yes. This one looks interesting. It's based on his grandfather's life. And then the nonfiction book I want to read is At the Existentialist Cafe, Freedom, Being, and Apricot Cocktails by Sarah Bakewell. I think you might like that, too.
Don't I have that? I have...
No, you might.
I have something
you
at,
should
the
read it.
At the Existentialist Cafe, but I think it's much more...
An older book?
Yeah, it's much more Sartrean or something. Yeah, it is. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't. It's because, like, Rebecca, who's the producer of the show, sets up so many interviews that it gets to the point where I feel like I'm cheating if I'm reading a book that's not one coming up and I don't have the time to do it.
Well, she is on it. She's booked you some wonderful authors.
I know. I mean, this year alone, we've gotten Man Booker finalists. We've National Book Award winners. We've gotten, and in the past, Pulitzer Prize winners. Mm-hmm. And people whose careers have actually started because of me on this show.
I think they have. People you were their launching pad, the avid reader.
Well, Paul Harding, when he wrote Tinkers, I mean, that was the year he won the Pulitzer Prize, and that was like his first interview.
Are we running out of time, or did we run out of time?
We already ran out of time, but he can cut it a little bit. You didn't get to your cookbooks.
Should we do that, or?
You can do this. I can say, look, so this is, it's December 19th, you can come out to the bookstore, which I strongly suggest you do, because I need to have income. And we have an enormous amount of all kinds of cool gifts this year, including all kinds of interesting bookends. We are essentially...
Beautiful bookends.
Very expensive bookends.
And some not so expensive bookends.
And
they're all 20% off.
Yeah, they're 20% off.
From now until Christmas.
And as I've said in the past, I mean, you can pretty much find anything you want to for anybody, your father, your mother, your sisters, your niece, your uncles, your grandchildren. You can do one-stop shopping at our bookstore without ever going near the mall or actually doing any cyber or anything.
You can walk around with a cappuccino and buy everything from an apron and a cookbook to a funny little tree ornament to a Pulitzer Prize-winning book.
Unless you're really irritating, in which case I generally kick you out of the store and give you $20. But I haven't done that in a while.
You haven't given me $20.
That's true. But I haven't kicked you out yet.
All right, so, yeah, can I just mention a few cookbooks real quick?
Yeah, so wait, the way this works is, like, we'll probably be, well, we might be off the air now, but if you want to continue listening to this broadcast, just keep going and go to the podcast, which you can find on iTunes, just under The Avid Reader, Notable Books, which is what this will be called, and you can do that with any of the episodes of our past 400 authors by looking up the author's name, the title of the book, or just going to The Avid Reader, where there's a list on iTunes or on Podomatic or our website.
All right, so I'll just quickly run down a few cookbooks.
Yeah.
Ina has a new one. It's Christmas, so Ina has a new cookbook, Cooking for Jeffrey. These two have been married for 48 years, and she's kind of built her whole career on cooking comforting, delicious foods, and Jeffrey's been delightful enough to test them out. But it's it's another good Ina cookbook. So if you're an Ina fan, you probably need to pick this up. Couple other ones: French Country Cooking, Meals and Moments from a Village in the Vineyards by Mimi Thoreson. This is a follow-up to her A Kitchen in France, 100 simple yet exquisite recipes from French wine country, 150 just beautiful photographs. It's a good cookbook and it is a beautiful cookbook, and I'm giving this one two thumbs up. Also, Food 52, A New Way to Do Dinner. is just shows how to plan, shop, and cook for dinners. They're healthy, they're good, but it also gives you a real plan of getting what you need and getting yourself set up, from grocery list to cooking timelines. So it's not just for beginners. It's a good place to start, but it's also got, I mean, if you're someone who's busy and got to put dinner on the table, this is a good place to start. Or if you know someone who's busy and's got to put dinner on the table.
Why is it called 52 anyway?
Well, Food 52, that's a whole brand of people who know cook. We don't have time to go into that. But and the next one I want to talk about is V Street. These are Philadelphia restaurateurs. They're the people who started Veg, and the Veg Cookbook was a big success for us. V Street is 100 globe-hopping plates on the cutting edge of vegetable cooking by Rich Landau and Kate Jacoby. It's 100 innovative vegetable recipes that don't always feel like vegetable recipes. They're full of spices and adventurous foods. And the cookbook comes from the second restaurant that they started, also called V Street. And it's all based on great ethnic and street foods of the world, some really, really yummy stuff. And then finally, one I just am in love with. I think I'm at the point in my life where I'm finished buying cookbooks, except I think I'm going to buy this cookbook. It's called Clean Soups, Simple Nourishing Recipes for Health and Vitality by Rebecca Katz. Another beautiful cookbook. 60 recipes for pure soups that are intended to restore. They look yummy, hearty, fortifying, and also really good for you, which is probably what we could use after a holiday binge session.
What are the other books that you talked about? Well, you talked about kids' books. You talked about cookbooks. We've done nonfiction. We've done fiction, most of the...
Yeah, we've got some good new graphic novels in. National Book Award finalist, March, which is a graphic novel I suggest people check out. The Hidden Life of Trees, we didn't get to talk about. It's What They Feel, How They Communicate, Discoveries from a Secret World by Peter Wolbin. If you are a fan of nature books, think Annie Dillard, Diane Ackerman. This is something to check out. It asks the question, are trees social beings? And the author makes the case that trees are like human families.
I was going to say, I leafed through this one.
No, that's very good, Sam. Well, leaf through it, and you'll never look the same when you go for a walk in the woods, or you'll never look at a walk in the woods the same way.
That's the thing about the bookstore, too. I mean, we've talked about all the things that are like right out there, but I've always said, and I've probably said it here before, too, is that what happens is you go to a bookstore and you're looking for a particular book, and when you find it, you see the books on either side of it, which is not going to happen when you go to Amazon. Even though Amazon gives you recommendations based on what you bought, you don't want a recommendation based on what you bought. That's the stuff you like.
You want a recommendation on what you want.
You want a recommendation on something you don't know anything about.
Exactly. You don't even know you want it.
Just like Steve Jobs. Yeah, he invented stuff that people didn't know they wanted. So if you go to the used book stacks in the back of the store, you find the book you want. On either side of it are books, and one of them might very well change your life. And also,
let me ask you something else. Read the Association.
Why do you interrupt me and I don't interrupt you the whole show? I can't interrupt you because you're talking. But when I'm talking,
I'm interrupting you because you're talking too much. I want to ask you about
a
book, The Association of Small Bombs. Didn't you read that?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, it's Karen Mahajan.
Where did that come from, though? I mean, we're just
talking. I know.
I'm closing this out.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just thought that was a big one.
It was. It was a very good book. It came, you read all the time about, bombs exploding in marketplaces. You read about, and then if one happens in the United States, everyone goes crazy for 2 weeks, and, it's on the news constantly, and it's breaking news, all that. But this is about a bomb that goes off in a small marketplace somewhere in Iraq, and the repercussions, literally and figuratively, of what happens when that goes off. Because, it never just affects the person that's hurt or killed. It affects all their people. And, so that's fathers and mothers and aunts and uncles and cousins and best friends. But it also, what it goes into, and it's like that book I was talking about, trying to delve into why fundamentalist right-wing people feel the way they do, is it also goes into the minds of the terrorists who set off the bombs.
Right.
And their response to what they've done, and whether they're like 100% with it, or whether they have feelings of remorse, or what gave them, what made them, what fear or anger or insecurity made them into the kind of person they've become.
Well, I apologize for interrupting you, but there are just so many good books out there. Jonathan Safran Foer has a new book, Here I Am. Annie Proulx's book, Bark Skins. Okay, I see you rolling your eyes at me. I can go on forever, but I'm going to stop. Yeah, stop into the bookstore, and we love to talk books.
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, if you listen to this today, or if you do pick it up on the podcast, stop in, because there's all kinds of deals going on, and maybe we'll give you a different deal than we're giving anybody else. Maybe we'll something special, or just come in and have a...
Yeah, mention you listen to us and get a...
Yeah, come in. Say you listen to this show.
Get, what, 25% off a hardback book?
Yeah, no, but you got to say something like, yeah, I listened to the show where Sam spilled the water all over.
Right,
that
or,
way we'll
or Donna was very clever and funny and kept him from rambling. That
yeah,
one?
Or sang Come Together. Yeah, if you indicate that you actually listen to this, the chances are slim and none. But if you do, then we'll give you something extra, like better than a cup of coffee. But you can always come in and get a cup of coffee. I don't mind. All right, so thanks very much for joining us again on this, I think, our third, who knows what it is.
Sam, thank you so much for having me. Oh, I thought you were thanking me. You were thanking the listeners.
I was thanking you. Anyway, so we will talk to you next time. And as always, thanks so much for joining us here today on The Avid Reader.